were asking if we ever got bargains that were too big for the firm to handle. That wasn't in a funny way. That wasn't our judgment. I mean, that was for the broker to decide by, and he would decide that by checking his price amongst the jobbers and seeing who made the closest price and the largest size. And clearly, the person who was not prepared to was feeling that the broker was asking too big a size would duck out, and by virtue of the fact of the price and size he was making. So the broker would make that judgment. Occasionally, though, the broker would come in and call both, in the case of the borough market where there were only two, would call in both jobbers because it was a very big order for some reason. And the brewery market was going through an intense period in the 60s of rationalisation. I mean there were, when I started, there were lots of brewery companies and brewery stocks, which are only names today and probably mean nothing to anybody. I mean, there were so many mergers and bids and going on in those days, and gradually, you know, the big four or five emerged. So while all that was going on, there was some pretty big business, and so the brokers would, you know, occasionally call both jobbers in because of the size of the order, and we'd do it together.
Mm. Were any other jobbers tempted to come into the brewery market?
I think they would have liked to have done, but they didn't, and I don't know why they didn't. Whether it was because the market worked so well that the brokers didn't encourage them to come in, or whether it was for other reasons, I don't know. But having said that, eventually they did. We did get a third jobber in, but not until much later.
Who was that?
That was Bisgood, came in. And even then, I think I'm right, for a long time they only did the majors. They didn't do what we call the second liners. My memory may be at fault on that, but you know, it rather compared to other markets where there were a lot more jobbers in those markets, and it was. It certainly could have sustained more jobbers, unlike other markets. But as I say, I personally believe, still to this day, that really that any no market should have more than three jobbers in them to really work well, providing they were all putting enough capital and liquidity into it, and two is perfectly adequate, or more than adequate, and could do a very good job.
What were your impressions of the stock exchange as an institution during this period, the early 60s? Did you feel it was a place that was moving with the times?
Well, in those days, one was new and green, and one wouldn't have presumed to know better than the stock exchange. At least I didn't. One did what one was told. My sort of impression now, looking back, was that they were very much more in control of events than they are today, or even were before Big, right, sort of leading up to Big Bang, before we really knew about Big Bang. There was a very, very tight circle drawn around the stock exchange. Continental markets really didn't exist very much, and I suppose because of communications and so on, even New York seemed pretty far away and whatever. And one's impression was that by the middle 70s they were beginning to flounder. That's being a bit unkind, but they were beginning to be caught up in the sort of world events and weren't so dominant as they were in the 60s.
What about in terms of the the actual conventions on the floor of the house. I'm thinking of dress and the way people behaved. You think of society generally moving during the 60s and changing. Was that something that was reflected in the stock exchange among its members?
When I joined the firm in 61, I don't think it was when I joined the firm. When I came down from the office to the floor as a blue button, the senior partner expected you to turn up in the office wearing a bowler hat. I bought one. I never wore it. I used to carry it to work, put it on to walk through the door and take it off again. I still got it to this day. We would never dream of turning up to work in anything but a white shirt and a stiff collar. And that sort of dress was, and that went across the board. I mean, other people, I mean, a lot of brokers in those days used to wear top hats, of course, and that tradition lasted amongst some firms right up until Big Bang. Government broker always used to wear the top hats.
So he'd come onto the floor of the house.
Oh yes,
with the top hat.
Oh yes, oh yes, oh yes, very much so. And if you look at old pictures of the floor in the sort of 30s and pre-war, probably, I mean, most people were wearing top hats. but by the 60s, that was bowler hats. And people used to walk onto the floor in their bowler hats. But as I say, it was very much white shirt and stiff collar. And the convention on the floor was that you weren't allowed to run. The other convention was that it wasn't until the middle 60s, certainly, that it became compulsory for members to wear badges with their names of firms on. And it was quite difficult for a dealer, a new dealer, to know who everybody was, but you were never allowed to ask. If a broker came up and dealt with you and you didn't know who he was, you were not allowed to ask who his firm was. So that caused a problem, because there you had a bargain. You dealt with a firm, but you didn't know who to book it to. So you were used to detail your blue button to run off and follow him to see where he ended up, which box he went into, or whether he got to a stand and you could ask a waiter. This, of course, caused problems if the chap then immediately walked out of the stock exchange and went up to the West End for lunch or something. Then the authorities had pity on us, I think, and it became, as I say, it was an obligation to wear a badge, although quite a lot of people didn't. But that solved that one. And then, of course, as the 60s gave way to the 70s, dress became more informal. The white collar went out, and somebody actually wore a coloured shirt.
Did the older members have feelings about these things, which they occasionally expressed?
I think the older members would express their feelings quite volubly occasionally, yes. Particularly if they found blue buttons running into them or treading on their toes or whatever. They would be quite sharp disciplinarians, yes.
How did your career with Atkin develop? You started as a member dealer in 1964, but you weren't a partner then.
I wasn't a partner. I became a partner about a year before they merged with Aykroyd & Smithers. And so I was the junior partner. And that was wonderful, because that was the first year as a partner, and I remember we had to dip into our pockets at the end of the year because we'd made a loss. So I thought, I didn't think much of this. So, and then we merged with Acroyd and Smothers, who you've been talking to Brian Pepin about,
yes.
And all their, they'd already merged with lots of other firms.
Could you describe the background to that from the Atkins side? I mean, why was it that you went into a merger?
Well, just before that, we had a brief flirtation, and indeed a sort of engagement, with a firm called Blackwell. That didn't work, and I wasn't a partner then, and I don't know quite the ins and outs, but obviously they didn't get on, the Blackwell partners and the Atkin partners. And I think the Ronnie Quirk and Francis Peck, who was the next partner, second senior partner, I think could see that the strategy that someone like the Durlackers were following in getting bigger and more market coverage and was necessary. We by the 70s. And looked around to find a suitable partner. Acroyd, by that stage, was a biggish firm. They'd gone through several mergers themselves during the 60s with having been a gilt-edged firm. They had decided that they needed the spread of equity. So they'd merged with several firms, and we were one of those, we weren't the last. That took place in 1970.
How did you actually make the decision? Did you all sit around with arms crossed and talk about it, or did someone make the decision and it was communicated?
I didn't have much say in those days whether I did what I was told. Mm. I'm sure the senior partner took the decision. Mm. Along with some of his, some of the more senior partners in the firm, although they had the equity, I mean they had the percentage of the equity, and they would have the votes.
Mm. How was it received? You said that in those days you did what you were told.
Oh, I think I remember it was received very positively, because it was pretty clear to everybody that, you know, in order to survive in the jobbing world, you had to get bigger. And you had to have a bigger spread of stocks you dealt in, because some markets, you know, if you ran the risk, if you were only in one or two markets, so those markets would be very dead for some reason, and you know, all the activity might be in the gold mines or the oils or the whatever. And I think we also liked the spread of having the gilt edge side of the firm. It was. So I think it was received. It was received well.
Mm. Had Atkin had difficulty with markets going dead during the 60s?
No, they had a. I mentioned that particular year was a poor year, 1969. It must have been, but only marginally so. Up until then, they'd had some moderate years, but really done quite well, and they'd been lucky. I think they had the decade of the 60s was a very active one for the brewery sector, with all these bids and deals going on. Mm. So they hadn't suffered a dead sector, the electrical market was also going through a bit of a rationalisation because. AEI and GEC, AEI and English Electric, no longer exist. They both went into GEC different times. But I mean, that stimulated that market at least. Mm. So we were lucky in that respect.
Mm. Had you been involved in any takeovers?
On the brewery side, involved in dealing while they were happening.
Yes.
Certainly. I mean, like too many to mention, actually. Mm.
Did you ever have any contact with the brokers who were amassing the shares for the?
Yes, we both wed both Derlecker and ourselves would be left orders by the brokers, and it was quite clear that they left us firm orders to buy certain brewery stocks, and it was quite clear they were buying for a Predator at some stage. Didn't mean to say that it was necessarily going to happen there and then, but somebody was amassing a stake, and the way to do it was to leave a firm order in the market, and with the two jobbers they used to more often than not used to leave it with both of us.
Did that put you in a difficult position in terms of people outside of the stock exchange wanting to find out whether anything was going on and coming up to you as jobbers in that market? And
the segregation between jobbers and others was pretty acute. Mm. I mean, you really didn't talk, and people didn't expect you to or ask you, actually. Mm. You didn't talk to anybody apart from other brokers on the floor, and obviously they would want to come and ask you what was going on, but you, if you were sensible, you had an order, and it was confidential, and you were discreet, and it was, they can ask, but you. You probably didn't tell them. Shouldn't have told them.
Speaking in more general terms, outside of the house, did journalists, for example, use you as jobbers as a source of information generally on how the various markets in which you were involved were doing?
The Stock Exchange allowed some newspapers, I think it was probably certainly the Financial Times, and maybe even I think the Telegraph had, used to allow those certain papers, certain newspapers, to have a blue button attached to a broking firm who was really working for the paper, not so much to get the sort of inside story and the gossip, but more to collect the prices, and that, you know, that we hadn't got any screens or anything like that. I mean, it was all done manually. So, but nevertheless, they obviously they picked up the gossip on the floor, but they always behaved absolutely extremely properly. And I think then the other way of the newspapers in those days would have gleaned their market information would be to. Would be over the road at in the various bars that was around in those days, many of which sadly have disappeared.
Did anyone ever come into the office?
I don't remember. I mean, jobbers were certainly our firm, and still probably to this day. We're very careful what we say, if the press found that they weren't getting anywhere, they tried other sources.
Well, thinking now of the period after the merger with Ackroyds, what did it in practice mean for you? Obviously, you weren't moved to a different book.
No, it didn't mean absolutely not. I stayed on the brewery book. It meant that pretty soon after the merger, I think I was actually in charge of it. Ronnie Quirk was, as you say, the senior partner, and was then deputy chairman of the exchange. He was in charge of all equities, all the firm's equities. Still, obviously, kept an eye on it. But I think I was in charge of the brewery book, which was very exciting. It also meant a change in structure in terms that we were. I don't think when we, by almost simultaneous to the merger, I think we became a limited company. Brian probably can remember that better than I can. So we had a sort of effective board of directors almost, so partnerships. Or the old partners, we all became employees. It meant I went on the pension scheme, for example. the firm, the senior partner of Ackroyd, was somebody called Hugh Merriman, a very much loved and respected senior partner, and ran the firm very much as a senior partner. Mm.
Was his approach to jobbing any different to that you'd known in the Atkin days?
He had come into Ackroyd from a small equity jobbing firm called R.M. Long, but then became involved on the Gilt Edge pitch, and his attitude, I think, was very much, leave it to the equity boys to get on with the equity business, as they always have done. Mm. So that's what we did.
Mm. Did jobbing itself change during the 70s? The actual business of jobbing on the floor, dealing,
well,
making
it
bargains.
Was by then it was becoming, the number of individual jobbing firms had dropped dramatically from the 60s, the 100 I mentioned, down to probably about 20. The number of people employed in the jobbing firms hadn't changed much, because by then everyone, it was beginning to polarize. You could see where the sort of main, the five or six or seven or eight big firms, where they were. And and the capital base of these firms had obviously grown, and the size of bargains one was doing was getting bigger, and consequently, I suppose, the risk was getting bigger, and the P's and the L's got bigger.
Were your prices getting closer?
I don't recall that. I don't think so. But competition was more intense, and in the equity market, firms wanted to cover the board in the equity stocks. They wanted to do all the major markets. We had a lot of discussions between ourselves as jobbers as to the way of regulating that, because clearly we all saw that to have seven jobbers dealing in all the stocks would be counterproductive as far as our own margins were concerned, and probably, well, we all felt, and I said earlier, I still feel strongly that, I think it wouldn't have done the investor any service. The thing would have got so competitive that I think the liquidity would have suffered, and the orderly markets that we like to keep would have been more difficult to keep. But nevertheless, there was always pressure for firms to take up more stocks and deal in more markets.
Who did the pressure come from?
Well, from the jobbers themselves, from the guys in the firm. They saw that there was huge business going on in the brewery market. Why aren't we in there, doing a bit of it? We're sitting here and finding a bit tricky in oil stocks. Why aren't we dealing in the brewery market? And we might say, well, see the oil market over there. It's had some good times. Why can't we deal? There's big pressure from everybody. So,
yeah.
And we formed a body which had no recognition by the council, really, called the Jobbers Committee.
Mm. Roughly when was that? Early 70s, mid 70s?
I would say it was early 70s. 73, 4, something like that. To try and to stop everybody being so competitive all the jobbers being so competitive that they, really sort of ruined their own markets. Mm. And it was a forum to discuss things. We couldn't stop anyone doing anything they liked, obviously, it was a forum to discuss things, to make other firms aware that if they did something, what the consequences could be. And it worked jolly well, actually. And it lasted really right up until Big Bang.
Mm. Would you aim to meet on a regular basis?
We met whenever there was a problem, whenever anybody wanted to do something out of the ordinary that they thought would cause a problem. And then we did, after a bit, we began to have a lunch once a month or something, or, you know, whatever. And it became a nice, rather nice little club in a sort of way.
Could you describe some of those, the kinds of problems that would come up in general terms? I mean, not necessarily mentioning specific incidents or specific firms.
Well, it was pretty mundane things, really, but they were pretty key to what we were doing all day. It may be that somebody, as I say, wanted to take up a stock, that a specific stock that we all, those that were dealing in it, felt there were enough jobbers in it, might extend to markets, take up a whole market, that we all felt was adequately covered. They might want to start, for some reason, being super competitive, and that really wasn't much of an issue. I mean, people can make the sort of size that they want to make. More importantly, I think, was the width of prices that were made on the floor. Because there was always a sort of supposed cartel on the price widths. And if somebody wanted to, if traditionally the convention was that there was a sixpenny price in GEC, and somebody wanted to make a fivepenny price or a fourpenny, eightpenny price before decimalisation, that squeezed the margins, and that was a change in convention. And we, by tacit agreement, we usually discussed it at the jobbers committee before it was done. Now, if somebody wanted to do it and they were hell bent on doing it, there's nothing to stop them. But we just, you know, it was a way of sort of regulating the market behaviour and order, and sort of in an orderly fashion, we hoped.
How did people from the outside looking at this feel? Did they somehow feel that you were all in conspiring together to?
Well, I'm sure they did. I'm sure they did. But I think at the same time they recognised that it actually in the end it was for the benefit and for the good of the community as a whole. Naturally, brokers and clients would like to have the closest price in the biggest size that they could possibly get. But there's a balance between something that is clearly so aggressive and so competitive, and we all wanted to be in business, next year. And it was in the interests of the brokers and indeed the clients that the jobbers were in business to execute the business next year. So, you know, there was a balance to keep. And I think, you know, it was, there were grumbles, of course there were, but in general, I think clients and brokers, you know, accepted it for what it was.
Did you actually have much personal contact with brokers, either on the floor of the house or outside?
Yes. I mean, a lot of contact with all the brokers on the floor. I mean, all day, every day. And I mean, that was one of the great attractions and the great enjoyments of the job was the stock exchange floor. And one of the biggest changes in one's life since Big Bang, if you spent 25 years standing on the stock exchange floor when you could see any amount of people on any day, to come up to an office where you don't see, that is a huge change, dramatic change, really, in quality of life and lifestyle. So you had a terrific contact with the people that came onto the stock exchange floor, not so much with the people who there were stockbrokers that I think had never came onto the floor in their lives, possibly. So you didn't know those so well, but we used to, our only contact with clients was through brokers. I mean, brokers jealously guarded their clients. They didn't like jobbers talking direct to clients. We weren't allowed to deal with them direct, but they didn't even like us to talk to them, some of them. But occasionally we would go, you know, brokers would ask us up to their offices for lunch to meet a director or somebody who was working for the company that you were dealing in. And one would try and, you know, reciprocate. And as I said earlier, jobbers had pretty menial offices, really. They didn't have to entertain clients. But we used to entertain brokers, and they had lunchrooms eventually.
Did you ever feel they had a... Well, they took a particular line with you as jobbers. Did they regard you as all as people who you had to have your wits about?
I think they thought we were... Brokers always regarded the jobbers as the enemy, if you like. I mean, they had their clients, they had their clients' business to do, and it was always blaming on the jobbers if they can't do it. And it's the jobbers trying to take too big a turn, and the jobbers being difficult. That didn't mean to say that one didn't get on with them. Mm. I mean, one did, and one had some wonderful friends and relationships around. They regarded us as I think as pretty sharp people, quite honestly. Mm. They didn't quite understand how the system worked. Mm. Even people who were on the floor really didn't understand how the jobbing system worked. I don't think very few people to this day really understand how it worked and what it was all about. Mm. There was a mystique about it. Mm. And if it wasn't